An Equation of State by Robert Reed. Narrated by Jennifer O'Donnell.
This is where we die. Our orders promise nothing else. A long, cold journey brought us to this place. Familiar stars and every navigational beacon have been left behind. What was it that our superiors envisioned? What good would the war accomplish in such a remote realm? Not that we offer doubts. Discipline doesn't allow doubt. Exemplary soldiers, we are instinct and orders and passion, wrapped inside diamond shells and EM threads, built to serve narrow, highly specific goals. Our purpose is to fortify our next position, making a convincing statement of ownership over an anemic wilderness. Our army falls through darkness, and then the local sun's light catches us and slows us as we wriggle our way out of stasis. Food is every army's first need. Comet ice and sunlight are eaten, then rock dust and iron dust and the radionuclides inside. Starved bodies grow into capable brutes, 10 grams or a full kilogram in mass, depending on duties. One of the next duties is to collect data, and that's why tiny scouts scatter, mapping an impoverished solar system. There aren't enough asteroids here to build even one respectable wall. Most of the local worlds are sterile, or nearly so. Microbes hide inside cold stone and buried seas, and the large gaseous planets sport living bubbles that know nothing about what lies past their clouds. Only one terrestrial world offers a self-aware biome. Water life is able to stare at its sky, making tiny assessments about the universe and its minuscule role in the business of stars and empires. Native life sometimes has value, but standards must be met, and this world falls short. The locals are too simple, too slow. Building fortifications from scratch is the better solution, and that's why we retreat to the outer worlds. Comets can be easily modified. We carve out holes and brace the walls and build guns and subtler weapons along with overlapping mechanisms to focus our rage on hated enemies. And most importantly, we hide. Shielded bunkers will keep us invisible, and when the army scouts arrive, they will see nothing. And that's how their army will be enticed into this brutal, lovely trap. The battle won't be won. Victory is impossible. We are a tiny army compared to the coming multitude, and every soldier accepts the blunt truth. I know this. I know because I belong to the diplomatic cadre, and reading thoughts is my first skill. Yet every sacrifice gives reason to celebrate. Colliding with us, our enemies will become weaker. And even better, our sacrifice will build worry among the survivors. Their forces will have to move more carefully, and every new solar system will require precautions, and that can only slow their progress across the galaxy. Even diplomats have to build the barricades, and I do that work gladly and efficiently, and then the job is finished. We are ready, yet no enemy shows. Most soldiers drop into a rejuvenative stasis, but not our diplomats. Fresh intelligence might arrive at any moment, and I'll have to parse the meanings. Except, of course, nothing arrives. Not one flicker of coded noise from any part of the sky, and there is nothing to do but remain alert and ready. This is the worst kind of pain, cultivating useless excitement. But what else can I accomplish? The question lets itself be asked. Possibilities offer themselves. And armed with my best argument, I approach our strongest minds, proposing a tiny mission that will mean very little to anyone, including me. My superiors want to deny my request, but I know how to read thoughts, and of course every diplomat understands how to present ideas in the best possible light. A conversation begins and builds, and suddenly my superiors realize that the creatures who mean nothing to us are suddenly just a little important. Go to them, I am told. Hide among them, they say. Select a few and make assessments, the orders demand. It is my honor, I say. All of us convinced that this will be a small distraction and nothing else. I stand among them and talk, and they ignore my simple language. Then I stomp a hoof and swish my tail. And one man delivers a fond pat to my flank, asking, "What's the matter, son?" I'm not his son. I am a horse that helps pull iron-rimmed wheels and a wooden cradle along with an iron cylinder open at the end, ready to throw iron balls at other soldiers and their horses. I swish my tail again, and the soldier sees what's wrong with the harness, loosening what was done badly by others. Most of the soldiers are talking, their language rather more complicated than the snorts and grunts produced by horses. I listen to each word, and my horse eyes see every color that the soldiers see, and quite a bit more. Details none of them could notice are obvious to me. Water infused with proteins and lipids. That's what these soldiers are made of, and their horses are made of. And I am too. I wove an animal as a disguise, and being a creature of pride, I made myself powerful and even-tempered and beautiful. Bred to be docile and strong, horses are still very poor helpers. Food demands are enormous, and we need frequent breaks if we aren't going to fall ill or collapse. That's why the horses and men are enjoying a much-needed rest before finishing the march. The dirt road ahead of us is lined with rail fences and farm fields and civilians who watch the blue uniforms and the cannons and the dust. Gettysburg waits near the horizon, and I'm listening to the preliminary sounds of detonating powder and men dying in slow, miserable ways. But where I am now is not the war. Where we are, the world is calm and warm and brightly lit. The fusion bomb in the sky brings joy, and one soldier mentions that roasted chicken should be enjoyed tonight if they can find a flock to raid in this next little while. Another soldier talks about home in Ohio. A third whispers to a left-behind lover. Mentioning the name, he sees the female naked in his mind. And I watch his smile, as well as the stirrings that move the water inside his soft body, preparing him for intercourse. This is my third war among humans. It is my favorite war. There's much to be enjoyed here. Causes that can be seen, and consequences that even dim-witted water appreciates. Each side is convinced of its noble purpose, as well as the doom to come if it fails. And both sides are sure to fail. Military triumph is often brief. This is because war occurs when the armies are approximately equal in power and reach, and every battle degrades the fighters. And broken soldiers often leave children who want revenge for their father's midnight tears. I am a horse, because horses always stand near the fight. I can make myself into any creature, including an upright beast that wears blue and talks about mating rituals and cooked birds, joking about his fear and his death when he isn't casting long gazes at the green hills to come. Why not be human? Because the temptation to influence these creatures would be too much. I never stop reminding myself of that. Yet something is happening, some portion of my mind shifting.
"Time to move," says the soldier in charge. "Looking good, son," says the soldier who likes horses, patting my flank with a flattened hand. I snort once, with authority. I don't want this man to die, which is the oddest thought for an entity like me. Empathy for a drop of water, and the warm, slow life inside that water. Another 50 wars need to pass before I begin to make sense of my impulses. These wicked, obvious thoughts, secretly dancing inside my mind.
Bombs plunging from the sky will kill him. Or bombs spat from howitzers. Or maybe the boy lives long enough to rise out of this hole, dying when hidden mines throw metal bits into his face. Machine gun bullets shredding his organs. Or these adversities will be survived, and he will slide past the barbed wire, allowing the enemy to beat his small, half-starved body with shovels sharpened for that one purpose. The boy's army is miserably provisioned, and his youth and lack of strength never help in the fight for rations. But tonight is a good night, an exceptional night. The little soldier has caught a rat, killing the meat and cooking the carcass over a forbidden fire. I am the rat. It's too simple to confess that I let myself be caught, or that I have feelings for this one boy. But I did walk into his snare, and I do have my feelings, and more than a century of living among humans has only enhanced my proclivities. Fire won't kill me, but the body sputters as the stick turns, and it's a beautiful sound. Fire changing muscle into a meal. I listen to the boy's mind, anticipating what is to come. A final feast before his own body cooks, in one fashion or another. He's thinking about that. Jet engines roar nearby, and he jumps. But those machines aren't worth concern. B-52s are the true killers, and flying so high, the boy will never hear their arrival. My ears are everywhere. I listen to bombers throttling their engines in Guam, and American soldiers laughing on the hill above. And like my companion, I listen for the footsteps of older, bigger men who would happily steal this prize from a boy. Select a few and make an assessment, I was ordered. I'm doing nothing else. Starved fingers can't help but reach out, cooking themselves a little before prying loose black flesh and molten fat. My disguise is delicious. I see that on the boy's face and in his thoughts. He eats, and I taste what I am to him, which is a wonder. Full of enthusiasm, he lifts the stick and carcass to his face, biting and chewing, even as his tongue burns. The rat bones are as sweet as the guts, and the stick needs to be licked clean, the same as each finger. Then the stomach lies, claiming to be full, and this doomed little boy soldier thinks about his mother and sisters in the north. Imagining each of them responding to the eventual news that he vanished while bravely fighting the imperialist invaders. There is no bravery, not in this world. 7 months of marching and hiding and shooting aimlessly and listening to propaganda have taught the boy the idiocy of courage and its minimal power in the world. Fear rules, along with the promise of deep sleep and feasts. Living water knows that much, and a kindred spirit sits inside the happy, unfilled belly. I intend to leave with his shit. Except I don't. Racked by gastric pains, the boy climbs deeper into the bunker. Water and poisons have to be dropped into a special hole. But when my chance arrives, I don't abandon him. Instead, I use my gifts for mimicry to place my mind beside his mind, strengthening the bonds between us. He thinks about that mother and the sisters. I think about the joy of a poor family who sees their only son and brother return from a fire that killed everyone else. But how can any boy survive this nightmare? Easily. My senses swallow his. Living hydrocarbons and fats are designed to be adjusted. Every poor world is full of untapped energy. And that's what I sip at now. 100 wounds and limitations are healed. The boy looks exactly as before, which is useful. A starved little body is what his fellow soldiers see when they find him squatting over the latrine, shitting out the last remnants of that feast. Jokes are made. The most brutal man suggests one prank, and it's the weakest man who acts on the advice. The boy is shoved, and everyone else laughs. Except their victim doesn't fall, and the boy needs a fresh push. Two men try to bully him. In the next moment, every man is dead. Which will have no consequence, because the bombers will target the slopes of this jungle hill, and by morning, nothing about these dead soldiers or their nature will remain. The boy and I gather up guns and the various enhancements. Knowing where the mines hide and where the Americans are watching, we scale the hillside without being seen. The enemy dies almost as easily as his comrades. Shots in the dark make no sound, covered with elaborate anti-noise. Each bullet strikes a brain. A quarter of the fire base has been murdered before the general alarm is sounded. Stolen claymores wait at the doors to the bunkers, and grenades are lobbed exactly where they need to be, and the panic builds, and grown men cry, and boys cry, and I hear every spoken word. But my little peasant boy hears nothing except the pain and chaos. His own pain is enormous. Intimate as we are, this fellow surprises me. His desperate love for life bleeds into these other existences. When I abandon him, he will murder himself. That's the kind of misery this brings. So many slaughtered, and dozens more begging for mercy from this invincible god. My assessment is made. Now I know this species better than I know myself. But I am a thorough god, killing my way across the hilltop, leaving nothing in the wreckage but a new rat and a clear, sharp sense of possibility. I am considered the 17th most powerful soldier on the planet. My army numbers in the billions, each soldier loyal and perpetually ready for a fight. We battled yesterday, one war won, and a second suspended so that the perfumed diplomats can have their chance to shine. I often say rude words about diplomats. Certain insults make humans laugh out loud, and the AIs emit joyful noises, though they have been carefully scrubbed of any semblance of real humor. This is one of the barricades against the machines. Humanity's job as stand-up comedians remains safe. A funny joke, and I laugh for my own reasons. "How's William?" my assistant asks. William is my husband, a genuine man married to an alien woven from proteins and wetness. William suspects nothing. "The poor fellow's nursing a cold," I say. "It's that time of year," the young woman offers. We're walking together in the quiet hallway. Human banter has never been more routine, more dreary. This once wild species has domesticated itself, living trapped inside offices and calendars, every career measured by tirelessly inaccurate means. I have moved among these creatures for nearly two centuries, watching evolution push them into a little box where they feel wise and know nothing. "I hope you don't get sick," she says, and I say, "Let's both stay fit. Agreed?"
"Yes, ma'am."
16 generals and admirals have more war-making power than William's wife, but she stands alone in being female, and more critically, not belonging to any military. Every AI, drone, and robot soldier needs rules, and an unranked but very talented civilian oversees an empire of software and legalities. But of course, human measurements are flawed. In reality, the most powerful force on this planet is me. The two women walk, and then the calm is interrupted. Entering the outer office, my assistant says,
"Oh, my apologies, ma'am. I forgot to tell you. You have a visitor from United Command."
An unscheduled visitor. And more unnerving, I haven't heard anyone besides the two of us. Vet it? I ask.
Yes, ma'am. The gentleman has full credentials.
Where is he?
Awaiting in your office, ma'am.
I offer thanks and leave her at the desk. My office is famous for its blandness, its lack of pretense. The most powerful entity on Earth normally sits happy inside what looks like a closet, crowded with monitors and diamond cables. But today, a man who shouldn't exist occupies the chair behind my desk, wearing a uniform composed of perfect details. The sneer could be a general's sneer.
You've done enough here,
says a voice that nobody else can hear.
You were ordered to return, and you haven't, and I've been sent to retrieve you.
I've dreaded this moment and feared it. But are there doubts? No. I'm full of certainties, and I always will be. As I explain to your superiors, I say, my work here isn't finished. Speaking with my human voice.
Finished or not, your work isn't up to standards.
The messenger says, with its mouth and tongue and new pink lungs.
And I will do whatever is necessary to bring you back.
I make a show of sitting in a guest's chair, smiling at that male face. No.
What?
Never, I say. At least not until I'm satisfied. The visitor has no patience for debate. A thousand clues tell me that greater minds have pressed a frontline soldier into this unsavory duty. The minds have already cobbled together parts of what I've been doing, and presumably they can guess some of the rest. Caution and violence. This soldier represents both elements. Munitions and more soldiers will be hiding nearby, ready to unleash aid. You don't need a diplomat now, I say. The visitor says nothing. Unless we have received intelligence from our superiors, I say.
I am your superior,
it says. I sit back, human nature showing with the careless crossing of one leg over its loyal mate. Give me another century, I say.
I'll grant you 10 seconds,
it says. Let's compromise, I say. Give me 5 minutes, although I probably won't need half of that time. Very powerful entities enjoy offering little gifts to the weak. The soldier wants to feel powerful, and that's reason enough to shrug and say,
3 minutes.
Why are we here? I ask.
Here?
Waiting beside this ordinary star, preparing a fortress against our invisible enemies, I say. The obvious answers don't bear repeating. It's more efficient to say,
orders,
and leave it at that. A hidden fortress lying in wait, I say. A nod, a human shrug. But what if we weren't the first to arrive? I ask.
What's that?
I lean forward, looking like a middle-aged woman in the midst of a long, successful career, which is exactly how I want to appear. We built our bunkers inside the ice. We hid. And we slept, waiting to spring the trap when our enemies arrived. But what if the masters who sent us here made a grave blunder, and our local superiors don't see the mistake? Our enemies were here long before we were. They arrived and laid the trap, and you and I have been too ignorant and too arrogant to recognize the genius waiting to pounce. The soldier says nothing to me. Busy sending reports across billions of cold kilometers. Light speed still rules the universe, and there is time.
These beasts are the trap,
it says. I say, perhaps,
unassuming as they are. You think they're the enemy's tools.
I have told lies in my life, and I have told the truth. But I've never done both so well as when I tell this soldier. It's amazing how quickly these creatures have advanced, and just in the last 200 years.
Nothing seems too remarkable,
the soldier argues. Yet it is impressed. The thoughtful water has achieved quite a lot. Yes. We sit and count time. And then it says,
3 minutes is finished.
Go back and tell our best minds this, I say. Tell them that I'm close to understanding. Explain that if they give me 2 more years, I will be able to decide if these humans are nothing but a brief little fire. The possibility tempts. But no. The soldier stands and alerts its allies. Too bad. I would have liked another 2 years to make ready. Or at least enough time to nurse my William out of his little bug. A vast system can be described using simple equations of state. This is true of atmospheres and stars, and even the most extensive empire. Tiny, tiny changes go unnoticed, and none of them matters. But then one more change arrives, and stability collapses. New states arrive suddenly, and they come as ice ages and exploding suns, and entities with more pride than power are forced to see their many failures. Human beings are not the trap. I knew this when I spoke to the messenger, trying to mislead. The trap is me, and always has been. Killing that lone soldier is easy enough. Its allies are just as vulnerable. Yet I let them battle me longer than necessary, which serves a role. My former colleagues know that I've been manipulating the living water, but they don't realize how much time and effort have been hidden from them. They don't see that the moon is a fortress ready to be occupied. They can't imagine that these human beasts are ready to make peace with one another, uniting against the alien invaders. And most important of all, they will never imagine that the Earth itself has been transformed. I am standing on a warrior built from everything powerful that I have ever found on this world. This little world is part horse and part rat. And it is a boy sitting in the stinking darkness, waiting for the idiot to give him that one careless push.